books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today a long chat with author and the first ever female head of MI5, Dame Stella Rowington. And to round off episode 420, we'll have some musical biographies new in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Dame Stella Rowington is a British author and former Director General of MI5. Her role in the service is considered a model for Dame Judi Dench's portrayal of M in James Bond. She's the author of both an autobiography and 10 Liz Carlyle novels, although more recently she's moved on to a new heroine, Manon Tyler. And as the second book in that series, The Hidden Hand, entered the RNIB Talking Book Library, I asked Dame Stella for a chat about all of her books and her former career. The audio version of The Hidden Hand by Dame Stella Rowington is narrated by Penelope Rollins.
"You're looking well,"
said Ben Fleischman. He was wearing one of his collection of sweaters, each featuring a different animal. Today's had two squirrels chasing a walnut, and his jacket was hanging from the back of his chair. He was a roly-poly bear of a man, with a ready smile. Behind his thick lens glasses, he had warm and friendly eyes that missed nothing.
"Have a seat,"
he said, pointing to a chair opposite his desk. As she sat down, Manon took in the smart new quarters of her former boss. He had moved to the central office building of the Langley, Virginia headquarters of the CIA. He had been promoted since she'd seen him last, almost 9 months before, and now occupied a large corner room high up in the main building with a view of the inner courtyard. Ben had encouraged Manon to switch to the agency's operational side, and she suspected his recommendation had been at least partly responsible for her acceptance into the training program. She had promised to come see him when she finished the course, for if she had anything approaching a mentor in the agency, it was Ben.
"This is quite the palace," she said, half admiringly, half teasing. Fleischman gave a self-deprecating smile. He'd always been appealingly modest, letting his juniors take credit, even when, behind the scenes, he had saved the day. He was known within the agency for his affable astuteness and his refusal to play politics.
Manon Tyler is a CIA officer. She's only recently joined the active intelligence side of the CIA. Before that, she was a researcher, and she was working on oil and gas. And her first posting, which is recorded in the first Manon Tyler book, was in London, working. She was supposed to be on the oil and gas, but she came across an old friend of hers who happened to be having an affair with somebody who turned out to be an illegal of the KGB. So Manon Tyler cut her teeth first on that case in London, and then went back to be trained as an active officer in the CIA and fell over this case, where she now is back in London and is working as a undercover officer trying to find out what's going on in an Oxford college.
"I had to move,"
he said, scratching the bald dome of his head,
"because my new duties include fielding courtesy calls from visiting firemen. So the powers that be decided I had to have enough room to host several people at a time in reasonable comfort."
He shrugged.
"At least it frees up the conference room for everybody else,"
he added.
"But anyway, here you are. It's been a while, Manon. You look great. Not everyone survives the course, and most look absolutely drained when it's finished."
"It was quite challenging," Manon admitted. It had lasted 6 months, the minimum time allotted to training recruits for the operational side of the CIA. The range of topics and activities had been extensive, everything from defensive driving to using the latest cyberspace encryption techniques. There had been plenty of written exercises and nightly homework. Physical fitness had also been part of the regimen. Each day, several hours were spent outside. Manon had always considered herself athletic, a keen skier and a good swimmer, but the past 6 months had set a higher bar than she was used to.
The Hidden Hand is the second Manon Tyler book. It's the first book I've done that relates to the Chinese, because I have mainly concentrated on the Russians that I know more about. But it occurred to me when I was thinking about it that probably the attack from the Chinese intelligence services, though more possibly more subtle at the moment anyway than the Russians, is something that's not really explored that much in books. So I thought I would have a go. So this time it concerns the activities of the Chinese intelligence service at universities, and particularly at a fictional college at Oxford University, where there are a lot of Chinese students and a professor who is very pro-China. And it is discovered that the Chinese students are being closely monitored by somebody who represents the Chinese intelligence service. And so we go on from there.
Now, you were last on Riddle and talking about Moscow sleepers. Have you left Liz Carlisle where she is in a little happy relationship?
Yes, I said to myself, should I go on with Liz Carlisle or should I leave her? Because after all, there are 10 Liz Carlisle books, I think. So she has met, Liz Carlisle has had a lot of problems with her love life in various ways, choosing unsuitable men. And then eventually she chose a rather suitable man who was French. But unfortunately, he went and got himself killed. So in the last book, last Liz Carlisle book, she finds a rather nice chief constable whom she gets on terribly well with and who has lost his wife and is therefore slightly bereft. And I think he's of an age where he might consider retiring. So I decided that she's getting on very well with him. So the future I see for Liz Carlisle is that she will marry her delightful chief constable and will then go on with her career while he looks after the sort of home side of things and everything else, enabling her to work and achieve in her profession. But I don't think I'm going to write that. I think I'll just leave that to everybody's imagination and proceed with Manon, who seems to be getting along very well.
Now, you yourself, as we said in the introduction, were the head of MI5. How did you get a start in the service? Did you get the tap on the shoulder, as they call it?
I did. Strangely enough, I got the tap on the shoulder in India, where I had gone. I had trained as a historical archivist. So I worked for a period of time in, first of all, in the county archive in Worcestershire. And then I went to London and worked in the India Office Library, which is still a wonderful collection of the records, diaries and all that sort of thing of the men and women who ruled India. Much of it consists of letters home from wives, often rather sad. So the letters are really, give an excellent picture of what life must have been for these people who went out to India knowing nothing about it at all. And there are then the private papers of the Governors General and all sorts of things. So I became fascinated by India at that point. And then one day my husband came home and said he'd been offered a job in New Delhi. So what did I think? Did I think he should accept the job? So I said, yes, jolly well do accept the job, because I foresaw that I would have a really exciting life in India. And I found I was just one of several diplomatic wives. And the rules for diplomatic wives in those days was that you were not allowed to work except within the High Commission. And very few jobs of my sort of level were on offer in the High Commission, as far as I knew. And so there I was, giving dinner parties and behaving like a diplomat's wife, appearing in amateur dramatics and all that sort of thing, when one day somebody tapped me on the shoulder which is the traditional route of entry to our intelligence services, was in those days. So I tapped on the shoulder and I was offered a job in what turned out to be the MI5 office in the High Commission. It's a small office, and the job I was offered was as clerk typist. I didn't actually know how to type, but that didn't matter. I think what mostly mattered was that I was deemed reliable and honest and all those things. And being the wife of a first secretary, I was thought to be going to be okay. So I took up this job, which was a part-time job, doing my two-finger typing and wrapping up mail in a sealed bag in order that it could be put within the larger diplomatic bag, which went off to London. And when I wasn't doing that, I helped out with the doctor, helped him out with his surgeries. I also went with a colleague to an Indian village quite near Delhi, where we were supposed to be teaching the teachers English. So that was my tap on the shoulder. And then when my husband's posting finished and we came back to London, I had a choice of whether to go back to doing archivy or whether I would apply for a job in MI5. And I decided that the latter seemed to offer more interest and excitement. So I decided to do the latter. And I went to a selection board wearing a hat, as you did in those days, and all women did, and a sort of, I think it was the days of the miniskirt. So I remember I was wearing a suit, a raw silk suit run up by an Indian tailor. But as far as I remember, it had a very short skirt. I got the job, which was, didn't know it at the time, was the women's job, because MI5 were running a two-tier system in those days. The women, they called the people who were doing the basic work, they were officers. So the men were recruited as officers and the women were recruited as assistant officers. So I became an assistant officer, which was the lowest professional rank of the low, when it was reserved for women, as things were in those days. We're talking now about, oh, I suppose, the late 1960s, early 70s, with the women as the helpers and the men as the sharp end workers.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
We'll be back with Dame Stella Remington in a moment, but for now,
brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Penguin Random House recently gave us Hope I Get Old Before I Die, How Rock's Greatest Generation Kept Going to the End by David Hepworth.
On the evening of 13th of July 1985, when Paul McCartney was brought before the crowd at London's Wembley Stadium in order to close the British end of the Live Aid fundraiser to help relieve famine in Ethiopia by singing his 16-year-old anthem Let It Be, he was greeted in the manner of a venerable ancient briefly stepping down from rock's notional Mount Rushmore in order to bestow his blessing on the kids who were gathered that day, largely for old time's sake.
This is a story of how enduring rock icons like Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen and many more have remained in the ever-changing music game. When Paul McCartney closed Live Aid in July 1985, we thought he was rock's grand old man. He was 43 years old. As the 40 years since have shown, he and many others of his generation were just getting started. This was the time when live performance took over from records. The big names of the 60s and 70s exploited the age of spectacle that Live Aid had ushered in to enjoy the longest lap of honour in the history of humanity, continuing to go strong long after everybody else had retired. Hence, this is a story without precedent, a story in which Elton John plays a royal funeral, Mick Jagger gets a knighthood, Bob Dylan picks up the Nobel Prize, the Beatles become of anything bigger than the Beatles, and it's beginning to look as though all of the above will, thanks to the march of technology, be playing Las Vegas forever.
At the time, it seemed faintly ridiculous to regard a veteran like McCartney as being in the same bracket as the relative youngsters who had planned the day. In fact, he had only recently celebrated his 43rd birthday. On the 25th of June 2022, when the same Paul McCartney was introduced to an even larger crowd at the Glastonbury Festival in Somerset, and simultaneously to the watching millions on TV, an occasion he instigated by singing his 58-year-old composition Can't Buy Me Love, or at least singing along with the crowd, who seemed wholly familiar with the words, despite the fact that only a minority of them had been born when it was released, he was seized on as one of the few things a 21st-century festival audience who had grown up in a wilderness of specialisms and subcultures could possibly be expected to agree upon. This occasion took place only a week after he had celebrated his 80th birthday. This time, there was no thought of apologising for the years. This time, the years were the point.
Hope I get old before I die. How Rock's Greatest Generation Kept Going to the End by David Hepworth is read by the author and runs for 10 hours and 44 minutes.
New in the library, we have Songbird, an intimate biography of Christine McVie by Leslie Ann Jones. It was donated to us by Bonnier.
A white weatherboard millhouse leans beside the Little Stour River, keeping watch over the village of Wickenbrew. Across a picturesque green with its 13th century flint-built church of St Andrew, green-shuttered manor house and grand Queen Anne rectory, lurks an ancient timber-framed alehouse known as The Rose.
Christine McVie was a quintessentially English rock star, as both the backbone and the beating heart of Fleetwood Mac. As famous for their occasionally life-threatening decadent lifestyles as for their musical brilliance, they were held together by this strong, constant figure whom they dubbed the mother of the band. It was Christine who contained the flock and always got them back on track, and yet her personal life was every bit as tempestuous as those of her bandmates, weathering affairs, divorce, addiction and fiery passion, all which bled into her now iconic songwriting. Told by an author who herself was friends with Christine, and with new contributions from those who knew her best, Songbird offers a true insider's view and a deep psychological insight into Christine as both a woman and a musician, the ultimate picture of a rock legend and a national treasure.
The homely inn, like the medieval Kentish village itself, is a quaintly photogenic refuge. Locals, walkers and occasional sightseers head here to sup and dine, to toast birthdays, weddings and funerals, to rejoice and to mourn, to ponder time both spent and yet to come. Creaking beams, wood floors and spitting log fires heave with fragments of the bygone and the blown. The prevailing mood is cosy, if a little restless. Non-villagers here are en route to somewhere else. Not all of them could tell you where they're heading. At a time in her life when she had burned bridges and turned her back on her bandmates to make a new home in this tucked-away place, Christine was a frequent visitor to the Rose. She dropped in every day, give or take at one point, around lunchtime or during the early evening, in need of human contact, as well as sustenance, and for want of anything better to do.
Songbird, an intimate portrait of Christine McVie, by Leslie Ann Jones, is read by Lucy Traeger, and runs for 9 hours and 50 minutes.
And we'll have two more brand new books later in the show.
And now return to my chat with Dame Stella Remington. Do you think, looking back, you would ever imagine that you'd become the Director General at that time?
Well, no, obviously not. I mean, I never imagined that I would be allowed to become an officer, let alone the Director General, because there was really quite severe segregation. But anyway, what happened was, as the 70s broke out effectively, so did Women's Lib. And we, there were one or two of us there by then who had, like me, had degrees and previous jobs at a reasonably senior level. And we got together and sort of discussed this and decided that we weren't going to put up with it. We wrote a round robin letter to the bosses saying, you know, why are we being segregated in this way? And we've got just as good education as the men and da-da-da-da-da. And they didn't know what to do, actually, because they came from the tradition where their wives stayed at home and did the flowers and made the house beautiful and all those things. And we were here, these sort of uppity women demanding to be professional people. So they didn't know what to do. And in the end, they decided they had to give some of us a chance. And I was the first one to be allowed to go on the course, which was supposed to teach you the skills that you needed to recruit and run human sources, which are one of the fundamental sources of intelligence, of course. So that was me setting out on my career with a most unsuitable exercise, which consisted, and we're talking about the early 70s, you had to go into a pub, and I was given my pub, which turned out to be a sleazy dump near Victoria Station, and sort of chat up anybody you fancied and try to find out as much as you possibly could about this person. And then, surprise, surprise, somebody from the course is going to come in and blow your cover by saying, oh, hello, Stella, how are you? I haven't seen you for ages. Whereas I'd said, you know, that I was Fanny Ann Smithers or something completely different. So that was a very embarrassing start to my career. And of course, extremely unsuitable exercise for a young woman in the early 70s in London. I mean, women didn't actually go into pubs much in London, certainly not that kind of pub in those days. So the whole thing was ill-conceived. I don't know whether they conceived it entirely to embarrass me and make sure I didn't pass the course or what. Anyway, I did pass the course. So I was allowed then to move up into the officer grade. And later on, after a bit of experience going out with the men, I was allowed to recruit and run human sources of my own. So that was the start of my career. And from then on, really, this division between men and women broke down, actually. And we were treated basically the same as any young person coming in from somewhere else or straight from the university or whatever. And in the end, I became assistant director, running a sort of small team. And then I became a director, first of all, of counter-espionage, which was an important post because, as I said before, espionage, particularly Russian espionage, was the main threat in those days. And then I moved to counter-terrorism, which by then, we're talking now about, you know, towards the end of the 70s, by then, terrorism was beginning to sort of show itself as the main threat, beginning, as far as we were concerned, with Northern Ireland, and then moving on to terrorism from all kinds of sources. So it was a busy job. I took it a few days before Pan Am 103, the American airline that was brought down by a bomber over Lockerbie in Scotland. So that threw me in at the deep end. And so I went on. And then eventually I became Deputy Director General. And then when the Director General retired, I became Director General. So that was my route up through the service, that course from part-time typist in Delhi to Director General. It took 17 years.
Now, you were not only the first female Director General, you were also the first head of British intelligence to be named in public. Was that dangerous at the time, especially since you mentioned Northern Ireland?
Yes, it became dangerous. I think the decision to announce my name was made in good faith by the government, who thought it was about time that the public knew more about our intelligence services, and particularly as the Cold War had come to an end or was coming to an end by then. And people were asking, well, you know, that's the end of spying. That's what we needed you lot for, and we don't need you anymore. Whereas, of course, we knew we were needed even more by the arrival of terrorism. So I think the government decided, without my knowledge, actually, that the next Director General should be publicly named. But they didn't decide anything else. That was the decision they took. And I was told sort of one day casually by the ex-Director General, or the almost ex, that I was going to take over from him. And also almost by the way, that my name was going to be announced. And I thought, hang on a minute, this is going to cause a fuss. Have you thought about how we're going to handle it? You know, is some government minister going to go on the telly and explain why all of a sudden they're announcing the name of a head of the service. And I was told, no, 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 it won't be much of a thing, really. I mean, you just say how delighted you are to have this important job, and then it will all go away. And I knew it wouldn't. And it didn't, of course, because the minute that announcement was made, it became an absolute, you know, huge news item. Woman to head MI5. It wasn't James Bond, obviously. It wasn't George Smiley. Then who the hell was this woman? And so we had photographers outside the house. They easily found out where we lived because I hadn't lived in any covert way at all. Just lived under my own name. One of my daughters was still at home and the other one was at university. I didn't really have time to warn either of them what might be going to happen. And it did happen. I mean, as I say, the publicity was enormous. People in the road started to complain that I was bringing danger to them. One woman said to me, I wish you wouldn't go to work just as I'm taking my children to school. The undertone of that was obviously that because if they try to shoot you, they might miss and shoot us instead. So that was the sort of tone, really, of a lot of the neighbourly comment. The newspapers thought it was all very exciting and kept trying to take photographs of me by, you know, lining up outside the house and such like. And all in all, when one newspaper published a photograph of our house on the front page, I think the excuse they gave was that one of my daughters had left her bedroom window partly open, and they thought that this was scandalous because it would offer a route in for people who were trying to kill us. And all that, I mean, it was all ridiculous stuff. So in the end, we had to move. We had to leave our house and move to a covert place where we could live under pseudonyms. That was me and my younger daughter. And finding a place to live was a joke in itself. The Prime Minister very kindly said that I could have a grace and favour flat in Admiralty House in Whitehall. So we went to see this place, myself and my younger daughter. We went in past the armed guards, went up to this flat, which was an enormous set of rooms, but the rooms were dusty. They had no furniture in them. The furniture, which was huge Victorian stuff, was all piled up against the walls. My daughter, seeing all this, said, I'm not going to live here, and walked out. And I thought, well, neither am I in that case. So we thanked the Prime Minister very kindly for his offer, and said that we'd find somewhere more suitable, as we had a dog and various other things, excuses we gave. So we did find somewhere more suitable, and we lived there for most of the time that I was Director General, which was 4 years. It itself was not suitable for occupation because it had been used as an observation post and was full of technical equipment and such like, but it was rapidly made fit for habitation, just about. And so that's where we lived.
Now, you mentioned that the end of the Cold War. Another part of the end of the Cold War was that you got to meet your Russian counterparts.
Yes. As the Cold War began, obviously, to be ending, first of all, manifested, of course, by the East European countries who were all declaring themselves as democracies. The Berlin Wall began to be broken down. Douglas Hurd, who was, I think he was foreign secretary at the time, went to Moscow to meet Yeltsin. And Yeltsin said to him that he was trying to modernise the KGB. And Douglas Hurd said that we'd just been legislating for our own domestic intelligence service. The Security Service Act of 1989 was the first time we were set on a legal basis. And he said to Yeltsin, as far as I understand it, would you like me to send someone from the Security Service over to explain to the KGB what working in a democracy was all about? And so myself, with a couple of colleagues, one from the Home Office and one from my own service, went off to Moscow. We landed at Moscow Airport to be met by three people from the KGB, clutching a large bunch of flowers, which they presented to me, which was not how I expected a professional visit to the KGB to begin. And so we went to the British Embassy, where we stayed with the ambassador, who explained to us all the things that were going on. Then we went and met the KGB in the Lubyanka, which is a huge red building. It was at a time Manning, the English Revolution, was the founder of the KGB's early origins, who was a guy called Felix Dzerzhinsky, had stood on a plinth in Dzerzhinsky Square, representing, you know, the power of the state. But he had recently been pulled off his plinth by a gang of people with a rope and a lorry, and taken off to some place where statues go to die. So that, there was this atmosphere of uneasiness around. So we went into the Lubyanka, and my colleague from my service, who had a rather highly developed imagination, said something about, "Can't you see the blood in every stone?" and such like. So that set the tone for the meeting. Anyway, we went into the meeting where there was a long line of KGB men sitting on one side of a long table, and we were shown to three seats on the other side. And we did our bit. We explained all about how you have to have, oversight and judges and God knows what, if you are running a secret service in a democracy. And they looked at us as though they thought we'd gone mad, and obviously had no intention of doing any of that themselves. And in the middle of this long line of KGB men was a small man who looked quite different. And he turned out to be the professor whom Yeltsin had put in charge of modernizing the KGB. And he looked completely out of his depth, and clearly was, because after the formal meeting, he said to me, "I won't be here very long." And he wasn't, he was out from that job very shortly after we got back to London. So the sort of efforts to modernize the KGB didn't come to anything. Who was in that line of KGB officers? I never found out, and I don't know to this day, except that one of them reminded me of somebody whom I'd met in Delhi, who had a particular shaped scar on his cheek, which I'd noted when I wrote a note back to MI5 from Delhi saying that I'd met these people. And I looked this up, and there it was, in describing this man. And I'm sure it was the same man who was in this line of KGB officers at the meeting. I never found out what he was doing, what his job was, but I don't know. So that was that. And when I got back from that meeting was when I was told that I was going to be the next director general, which came as a shock in a way, because, normally if you're getting a job, particularly a senior job, you expect to have applied for it at the very least and to have had some kind of an interview and such like. But I had had none of that, because the system for appointing directors general was a murky mystery. And I think senior persons in Whitehall obviously sat down and discussed what they knew of the senior officers in the service at the time, and then made a recommendation to the Prime Minister, who agreed, not knowing any of them very well. And there we were.
You've taken that amazing career and channeled it into the Liz Carlisle novels and now the Man on Tyler books, which we've heard at the start narrated by Penelope Rollins. Did you have any choice in the narrator of your books?
No, I didn't have any choice, no. But I like Penelope Rollins. The way she reads it, I think, is very good.
Would it be difficult for you to see, Lehman? Maybe find out a bit more, like the name of this man at the embassy? Could your friend Louise help you to do that?
Normally, I'd say yes, but Lehman's already left for Oxford. She's now attached to one of the colleges there, St. Felix's. Fleischmann nodded and sat thinking for a moment. Then he said,
"In that case, I might give Dave Saunders a call over in London."
Manon stood up. "I must run. I'm viewing an apartment in Georgetown. Have you heard that my next assignment is here in Langley?" He saw her disappointment.
"Cheer up,"
he said.
"I know you might have preferred a foreign posting, but remember, Manon, this is where the real decisions are taken. This is the heart of the business."
He paused for a moment, thinking, and then added slowly,
"But things can always change. Don't sign anything on this apartment you are seeing, just for the moment."
"I won't. It's just a first viewing."
Why was Ben telling her to go slow with this? Did he have something in mind for her? Something elsewhere? Don't get your hopes up, Manon thought. But she couldn't stop them from rising.
And do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself?
I listen to audiobooks all the time because my eyesight is now... I've got macular degeneration and my eyesight has now reached the point where I actually can't read print or anything very much, actually, because the... I don't know, I've got glasses, but it doesn't terribly help. The print sort of floats around and my two eyes don't sort of meet very well, I think. So everything's blurred. So I do have great difficulty in reading. So the books are an absolute marvel, as far as I'm concerned. I was registered as partially sighted about a year ago, I think it was. And since then, I joined them, the talking books. As I say, I am hardly off them in my leisure hours. So they're a huge boon to me. And thank you very much for that.
What is it you're using to write now?
I dictate to my computer, but I can't read what it's written. So somebody else has to help me, which they are doing. Members of my family are being incredibly helpful. And particularly what happened was with The Hidden Hand was when I started, I was still able to read quite large type, but gradually, and it took quite a long time because in between that, I fell over and I had all kinds of problems with my back and everything. So I don't think that helped either. I ended up not really being able to see what I was typing. So I had to have help from my husband and my older daughter, who claims to have been typing the last chapter at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I think is true. So, yeah, so that's all. I don't have anything else. Various kind people from various organisations have come around and tried to offer me magnification things, but that doesn't actually help because my eyesight is gone wonky and magnification's not the answer. I know that I can get my computer to dictate and to write and to do all kinds of things. I'm sure I haven't explored it to its depth, but I'm not sure how much it's going to help.
I was talking to some blind writers and they recommended three things. VoiceOver, which is Apple's sort of built-in voice for the computer, and they also recommended a piece of software called Jaws.
Jaws? Like
the shark, yes. Or there's another version called NVDA. They say they take a bit of navigating, but once you're used to it, it is like having your computer back.
Oh, right. But I'm not sure about typing. That's the trouble. Because I suppose I could try. I can't really see the letters on the keys, but I know where they are broadly. I might have a look at those two. Thank you for the suggestion. Because if they work for other people, then they probably work for me too.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we're downloading the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of The Hidden Hand?
Oh, yes. The jacket. I like this very much, actually. I think it's one of the nicest, partly because of the colour. The cover is of what looks like an ancient archway looking through to a blue, sort of a blue background on which are two towers that look kind of vaguely university-ish, with in front of them is a girl running towards them. And then across the middle is my name. And now, and then down at the bottom in yellow writing on the black, which surrounds the rather pretty blue, it says The Hidden Hand. The figure on the front is a running girl blowing back and her coat open and blowing open. And she's running, giving the impression of urgency, I suppose, that she's running towards the problem and it's urgent. I think the colours on this one are beautiful. That's the front. And then on the back, the same arch is there, framing the same blue. But instead of a figure, there's all kinds of comments on other books that the publishers think will entice people to buy this one.
I write to alert you to a pattern of sabotage and theft which is being perpetrated within the institute of your beloved university. I myself have been watched and surveilled by a fellow student, Mr. Chu, who, for no reason, I discovered in my private room at the Elm examining my belongings. I discovered, too, that Mr. Chu has been in the laboratory in Parks Road, where I have been researching. I am not the only victim of such intrusion, and besides, there are many all too willing to help him gather information, which is then sent back to the government of the People's Republic of China. It is the price exacted by the authorities for paying our study fees and living expenses. Do not blame the others, but also do be aware.
The Hidden Hand is available now in print as an e-book and an audio both commercially and available from RNIB Talking Books. And Dame Stella Remington, thank you so much.
Not at all.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
I've been involved in the Talking Book service for a long time, since I was just starting out as an actor.
Julian Fellows on supporting Talking Books.
I suppose what draws me to it is that my whole life has been based around the word, you know, as an actor and then a screenwriter and a novelist and everything else, and the thought of being deprived of the word is terrifying to me. But also what it is really crucial to the Talking Book service is it makes blind people autonomous. You want to get back some of the pleasures that you knew before, and the one that can come back 100% unqualified is reading a book, and that is because of the Talking Book service.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Dark Desert Highway by Mick Wall was given to us by Trapeze from the Hachette Group.
Early on, I sent letters to Don Henley and Eagles manager Irving Azoff informing them that I was working on the book and asking for their cooperation in the form of a series of interviews. I emphasized that this was not a tell-all, and that I believed my previous work spoke for itself, and that I was giving them the opportunity to challenge or dispute any material I might uncover in my research and provide properly documented corrective material. Their response was to tell me to go.
This could be heaven or this could be hell. So sings Don Henley on their biggest hit, Hotel California. Yet for the Eagles, their story was one where the dividing line between ultimate Hollywood highs and subterranean LA lows was blurred beyond recognition, blinded by white powder double visions and buried beneath greenback mountains. The story of the Eagles is a truly gothic American fable, one of the ultimate power and rivers of money, of sex and drugs at a time when both were the lingua franca of sophisticated SoCal living, of a band who sang of peaceful, easy feelings in public while threatening to kill each other in private. In this book, esteemed music biographer Mick Wall provides the definite insight into America's best-selling band of all time.
Much of Felder's history with Henley and Fry is fraught, to say the least. During the final show of Felder's first stint in the Eagles back in 1980, Fry turns to him on stage and hisses, "When this is over, I'm gonna kill you. I can't wait." Nonetheless, Don Felder rejoins for the Hell Freezes Over tour in 1994, but is sacked again in 2001. He sues Fry and Henley for wrongful termination. Don and Glenn countersue him, and the case is settled out of court. Then Don publishes his book. 8 years later, talking to the Guardian newspaper, Don Henley says, "A lot of people on the outside believe a lot of the bullshit in Don Felder's book and believe Glenn Frey and I are some kind of tyrants. The fact is, we are largely responsible both for the longevity and the success of this band, because we did it our way and a lot of people didn't like that. Felder's just bitter because he got kicked out of the group, so he decided to write a nasty little tell-all, which I think is a really low, cheap shot. I mean, I could write some stuff about him that would make your mustache curl."
Dark Desert Highway by Mick Wall is read by Jeff Harding and runs for 11 hours and 25 minutes.
Hey ho, let's go. The Story of the Ramones by Everett True.
I saved up for weeks to buy Too Tough to Die on import and was so excited when I took it back home. The first time I took it out of its sleeve to play on my Dansit mono record player, my tiny white kitten, who was also excited, jumped up onto the vinyl as it spun round on the turntable. The cat and I then embarked on an exciting game of hide-and-seek round the house while Joey's voice sounded out, poignant and raw and scratched.
From their 1974 debut at New York's premier punk dive, through the classic albums and blistering live sets, the Ramones cut an unforgettable sway through two decades of pop. They set the scene for punk and hardcore with honed-down songs and ferocious 20-minute sets, and they always put the music first. Seen through the eyes of the people who were there at the time, including musicians, managers, producers, publicists, and New York punk scenesters, it's all here. The breakups, the bathos, the Budweiser ads, the blistering live sets, and the background to all those classic albums.
London Electric Ballroom, 29th of the 2nd, 1980. One of the first times I saw Ramones was also one of only two times I took my shirt off while dancing. I was so hot, and the whole venue was going berserk, jumping up and down. In the distance, I spied one other person with his shirt off. So, I thought I'd pogo my way over to him. It was my brother Michael, the one who turned me onto the Ramones and pop music back in 1976. The same brother I once mistook for Joey in a photograph in Punk magazine. That famous shot of Joey cuddling up in bed with Debbie Harry. I didn't even know he was at the show. On the way back down the underground, I led the chants of Hey Ho, Let's Go.
Hey Ho, Let's Go, The Story of the Ramones by Everett True is read by Russell Bentley and runs for 16 hours and 8 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally on today's show, one last time with Dame Stella Remington and the Books of Her Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Strangely enough, the books I remember best from childhood were those I listened to on Children's Hour. I was born 4 years before the Second World War broke out, so I must have been about 4 and a half or so when we were listening to Children's Hour. And I remember at some stage, I suppose this went on all during the war actually, but at some stage there was a book by E. Nesbitt, I think it was called The Enchanted Castle, and it was about children sort of wandering through this castle. And there was weird things kept appearing, as far as I remember, and there were these people called the Ugly Wugglies. And my brother and we both had the same sense of humour. And the idea of people called the Ugly Wugglies, we thought was hilarious. And they spoke. And what do you think they said? They said, "Can you recommend me to a good hotel?" This stuck with my brother and myself all through our childhood and further on into our adulthood. Whenever we met, we used to say to each other, "Can you recommend me to a good hotel?" And then we'd roar with laughter. So I think that I did read other books, obviously, but that, if you want me to remember a book that made an impression on me, that was it.
"Can you recommend me to a good hotel?"
The speaker had no inside to his head. Gerald had the best of reasons for knowing it. The speaker's coat had no shoulders inside it, only the crossbar that a jacket is slung on by careful ladies. The hand raised in interrogation was not a hand at all. It was a glove lumpily stuffed with pocket handkerchiefs, and the arm attached to it was only Kathleen's school umbrella. Yet the whole thing was alive and was asking a definite And for anybody else, anybody who really was a body, a reasonable question. With a sensation of inward sinking, Gerald realized that now or never was the time for him to rise to the occasion, and at the thought he inwardly sank more deeply than before. It seemed impossible to rise in the very smallest degree. "I beg your pardon," was absolutely the best he could do. And the painted, pointed paper face turned to him once more, and once more said,
"Oh, Henry,
you want an hotel?" Gerald repeated stupidly. "A good hotel."
"Oh, O-L,"
reiterated the painted lips. "I'm awfully sorry," Gerald went on. One can always be polite, of course, whatever happens, and politeness came natural to him. "But all our hotels shut so early. About 8, I think."
"Ah,"
said the Ugly Wuggly.
The Enchanted Castle by E. Nesbitt is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Elizabeth Proud.
Oh, good. I might try that.
Now, is there a book that on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes, anything by Dorothy Sayers, and particularly I think Busman's Honeymoon is the one that I go to. I know it very well, so I know exactly what's going to happen and what happens, etc. But it seems to me so comforting, you know, the idea that they got married to begin with, and that was exciting and nice. And then they went off to their what they thought was going to be their honeymoon house, and they found it was all locked up and completely deserted. Lord Peter Wimsey had, of course, bought this house, and the then owner had promised it would all be ready for them, but it wasn't ready at all. It was all locked up, and they hadn't got any food or anything. And the magnificent butler, who is the gentleman's gentleman of Lord Peter Wimsey, magics everything up and organises it all, and then they find the owner, who is dead in the cellar. I get comfort from those sort of books because you know what's going to happen, and it's all lovely and English countryside and all that stuff. So that would be the one I would go to.
Mr. Mervyn Bunter, patiently seated in the Daimler on the far side of Regent's Park, reflected that time was getting on. Packed in eiderdowns in the back of the car was a case containing 2.5 dozen of vintage port, and he was anxious about it. Great speed would render the wine undrinkable for a fortnight. Excessive speed would render it undrinkable for 6 months. He was anxious about the arrangements, or the lack of them, at Tallboys. He hoped everything would be found in good order when they arrived. Otherwise, his lady and gentleman might get nothing to eat till goodness knew when. True, he had brought ample supplies from Fortnum's, but suppose there were no knives or forks or plates available? He wished he could have gone ahead, as originally instructed, to see to things. Not but what his lordship was always ready to put up with what couldn't be helped. But it was unsuitable that his lordship should be called on to put up with anything. Besides, the lady was still to some extent an unknown factor. What his lordship had had to put up with from her during the past 5 or 6 years, only his lordship knew, but Mr. Bunter could guess. True, the lady seemed now to be in a very satisfactory way of amendment, but it was yet to be ascertained what her conduct would be under the strain of trivial inconvenience.
That's Stephen Jack reading from Busman's Honeymoon, a Lord Peter Wimsey novel from Dorothy Sayers, available in the RNIB Library. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book. Some you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, and you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I think the Strike series, written by J.K. Rowling under a pseudonym, Robert Galbraith. There are 6 of them, I think. All those who are addicted to these books are waiting for the 7th, which we hope will conclude something about the relationship between Strike, who is an ex-soldier who was fighting in Afghanistan when his leg was blown off, and he was ages in hospital, and he now walks with a wooden leg. So he is marvellous. He solves all kinds of problems that the police, who are not very bright, of course, fail to solve. So I would go to any of the Strike books. I don't know why I'm attracted to this kind of whodunity thing, but I am. I find them so relaxing. I mean, I don't mind whodunit or how it works out, but I love the idea of people walking around London, you know, finding clues and going into the pub, and you know, it all sounds so cozy somehow. So I think that's probably what appeals to me. Yep. So I would go for any of the Strike books.
Though Robin Ellicott's 25 years of life had seen their moments of drama and incident, she had never before woken up in the certain knowledge that she would remember the coming day for as long as she lived. Shortly after midnight, her long-term boyfriend, Matthew, had proposed to her under the statue of Eros in the middle of Piccadilly Circus. In the giddy relief following her acceptance, he confessed that he had been planning to pop the question in the Thai restaurant where they had just eaten dinner, but that he had reckoned without the silent couple beside them who had eavesdropped on their entire conversation. He had therefore suggested a walk through the darkening streets, in spite of Robin's protests that they both needed to be up early, and finally inspiration had seized him, and he had led her, bewildered, to the steps of the statue. There, flinging discretion to the chilly wind, in a most un-Matthew-like way, he had proposed on one knee in front of three down-and-outs huddled on the steps, sharing what looked like a bottle of meths. It had been, in Robin's view, the most perfect proposal ever in the history of matrimony.
That's Robert Glenister reading from The Cuckoo's Calling, the first Cormoran Strike book by Robert Galbraith, available from RNIB Talking Books. And Dame Stella Remington, once again, thank you so much.
Not at all.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.